The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you when they probably never have. Told you turn the other cheek and they met it with a bat. Fuck them protests in them cities. Told you go fight in the war. Vietnam, you died, good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around and pump crack right up in your city. And they turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called the National Guard up because we ride with our guard up. And that was blood in your guard. The Second Amendment don't apply to you. Everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue. One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. The one day you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
Good afternoon. You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines known as USA Inc. Today's date is October 12, 2015. It is a Monday afternoon. I hope that you all made it through the weekend safe and sound, that nothing happened to you, especially if you attended the Justice or Else rally that was held in Washington, D.C. on 1010. That was on Saturday, because a lot of people traveled from all over the country to go there. And I haven't heard any reports about any of our people being victimized in D.C. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, because it hasn't been reported. But for the most part, I have heard no such tales of Black people being brutalized in Washington, D.C. as they attended the Justice or Else rally. And we certainly, again, hope that everybody made it home safe and sound. Now, today we do have a guest scheduled for you. During this first hour, we will be speaking with Miss Gerald Sanders. She's been a guest on the program before, pretty recently, matter of fact. She is the president of Own Us, Inc. Own Us, Inc. is calling upon families all across America who have been victimized by police to join with them to strip law enforcement of unbridled power. The Strip Law Enforcement of Unbridled Power marketing campaign will educate the public about the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act. So we certainly look forward to speaking with Ms. Sanders about this particular legislation that they are putting forth. And of course, I believe Own Us Inc. is also a contributor, part of the 1 million conscious Black voters and contributors, a number of people who have come together to try to come up with solutions for the problems that we face under a system of racism and white supremacy. So she should be joining us here in just about 6 minutes or so. And I definitely want to talk about the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act. I have linked to it. I think that what they are proposing is reasonable, and it is certainly doable. All right. But we know that the people who are in positions of power, part of the system that is oppressing so many people, behind these enemy lines, that they won't do anything on their own. It has to be a tremendous amount of pressure put on them. Like Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, once said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And so if we can get a million people demanding whatever it is they are proposing, then you increase the likelihood of that proposal or that demand being met. Because there's strength in numbers, okay? And we amplify each other's voices. And so, again, can't wait to discuss the uniform. Excuse me, let me get that up again. The Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act. In fact, some of the things that it's proposing, I have talked about in light of the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Holder. Excuse me, I was about to say Loretta Holder. Loretta Lynch. I was thinking of Eric Holder, who has called for some of the same things that on us is calling for in the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act. But Loretta Lynch said that, you know, it's pretty much unreasonable for the federal government to put a mandate on police departments to collect the statistical data of the number of people that they have killed. And I'm not going to rehash that, but that is in the podcast. And again, some of what the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act calls for is that type of reporting. So I think that they have put together a great proposal, but we want to talk about it more and ask them what do they need in terms of our support from us to help them, you know, push this legislation that they are proposing. Now, after we speak with Ms. Sanders, I am inviting callers to share their thoughts and experiences. If you attended the Justice or Else rally over the weekend, or if you watched it on television, or if you watched it streaming online, which I attempted to do, but I was having internet service provider problems with that. But the speech is posted online. Well, the entire event, all the speakers, there is a video on YouTube. The Final Call posted it on YouTube. But we just want to review. I just want to review what Minister Farrakhan had to say. Now, of course, we won't be able to cover it all today, because as I was preparing for the program, I saw that he had spoke for well over 2 hours, and this is only a 2-hour program, and so obviously we will I will be forced to during the rest of this week you know, go over what he had to say. I'm going to play that speech, and we'll probably like listen to like 20 minutes of it, 30 minutes of it, take a break, break down what we heard, what we're looking for, what I'm looking for. I can't speak for anyone else. What I'm looking for is some useful constructive suggestions to see if any kind of directives were given, any kind of proposals were given that we can implement that is going to provide relief from all of this police terrorism, since, you know, the Justice or Else rally, that is the main thing that it was supposed to be focusing on, or at least that's what it was promoted to be focusing on, is getting justice for all of these victims of police terrorism, and which we know that's just a part of the element of 21st century slavery and human trafficking. So, certainly, we just want to go over that, analyze what was said, and if there is, again, any constructive suggestions that the minister made. It's not to bash anyone or anything like that. I've heard other people talking about it. Some of the same criticism that the minister gets, and that doesn't mean that criticism is invalid or anything like that. I thought some people made some good points. But see, whenever you're dealing in the people activity area number 7 on Neely Fuller's list of 9 areas of people activity, religion is going to cause division. That's just a given. All right. And there was a lot of religious overtones from the various different speakers that I was able to catch. And that's just a turnoff for me. And that is one of the reasons why Malcolm X, I'm trying to think of the professor's name. His name escapes me right now. But those who came together to create the African-American unity organization, the Organization for African American Unity, which Malcolm X, again, was one of the co-founders of that movement. The movement unfortunately died with him when he was assassinated. And so, but it was meant to be a non-religious organization, pulling people together that have something in common. And that thing that they had in common was what? Oppression under the boot of white supremacy. And so, I'm just turned off by religion. I'm certainly, everybody has a right to practice whatever spirituality that they are into or whatnot. But when we're talking about trying to unify people around issues and whatnot, it's best that we speak of those things in non-religious terms. All right. So I think we are joined by Mrs. Sanders. Ms. Sanders, do we have you on the line, ma'am?
Yes. How are you today?
I'm not going to complain too much because I'm sure it's people in a worse position than I am behind these enemy lines. So I try to taper any complaints that I have, keeping that in mind, because I have to say I'm relatively blessed as opposed to some of the other victims out there. So I don't like to complain too much, if you can understand that.
I can certainly understand that. I can. It definitely takes a lot, though, to not complain these days.
yeah. And not to say I don't ever complain, but I direct them complaints at the white supremacists that's responsible for it, and the proxy racist tools that they use to do what they do. But it is good to speak with you again. I'm very excited to hear about the campaign that On Us Inc. has, Strip Law Enforcement of Unbridled Power, the marketing campaign, the media campaign to educate the public about some legislation that you all have put together and come up with, that's called the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act. And I have a link to that for the listeners. I also have gone over it myself. I think there's a lot of constructive suggestions there, and I think that what is contained there is totally reasonable and should be implemented immediately. Okay, so I just want to thank you all, yourself and those who work with you to put this together. I want to thank you for your constructive effort to bring relief in the form of codification to our people.
Well, thank you so much for that. It definitely is it's essential. We've been being killed, people of color, for centuries, and nothing has been done about it. And it's time to say enough, to take responsibility for correcting the problem into our own hands, and to see it through.
Yes, ma'am. Before we get started, let me just remind the listeners of the telephone numbers. If you have a question, comment for our guest today or for myself, you can give us a call at 641-715-3660. Again, that's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. Again, that's 549-032-POUND. Greetings to those already dialed in listening. At any time you would like to come on air, just hit *6 and 1, and that'll send me a signal, and I will get you on air. Also, you can use our web-based flash phone to call in from anywhere in the world, as long as you got an internet connection and a pair of headsets. That's a free call for you, and that'll put you in the conference line. The other way is to call our studio line, which is 704-951-5030. That is 704-951-5030. Thank you. Ms. Sanders, before we get into the meat of our discussion and why we invited you on the program today, for those who may not have heard, your last time joining us on Black Talk Radio Network or on Black Talk Radio News, can you just give them a little bit of information about On Us, Inc., I've already linked to the website, but if you'll give out that website information and any other contact information you would like to have, but would you just briefly tell them again what the mission of On Us, Inc. is?
Well, On Us, Inc. Is a nonprofit, a 501c4, that is engaged in our mission of resolving long-standing problems that seem too big to fix. Our motto is change is on us, and we believe that many of the problems that our community face will remain until we take the onus upon ourselves to resolve the problems ourselves. So, and to that end, we have embarked upon a campaign to address the police killings and to bring an end to that. Now, with respect to you can find us at www.changeisonus.org. That's www.changeisonus.org. And you can reach us at info@changeisonus.org, or you can call us at 202-817-1331.
Thank you. And let's talk about, and after we discuss the Uniforms Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act, after we speak about the contents of that proposal, then we'll also talk about the campaign to educate the public about it. So let's start with discussing this proposal. Can you give us some background on the proposal? What was the process like? How long did it take? What was the input? I assume that other people worked with you on this. So if you could just give us an overview of it, and then we'll get into the details.
The process, basically, we used a corporate or business process to address a social problem.
Okay.
And a very strong component of that, it has to do with quality improvement. So we began by first analyzing the problem. We looked at the different scenarios where African Americans and people of color or people or even whites were killed. Wrongly so, and law enforcement agents were able to escape responsibility for their actions. So after we looked at those problems, we then looked at policing overall to see what were some of the problems that were responsible for so many people of color being relegated to prisons and a life of incarceration, and what were the breakdowns in the system. So having identified all of those, we systematically formulated solutions for each problem we identified and encased it in the form of the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act, which is a legislative proposal. And I want to emphasize it has not yet been adopted by a congressional leader. It is a legislative proposal. Now, in addition to having formulated this legislative proposal, we did not want it watered down. We had been told by some individuals that some of the congressional leaders, when they had written legislation, would tell them, look, don't bring me legislation with penalties in it. Don't bring me legislation with this. So we made the decision that we would write legislation that we felt would really do the job, and then we would marshal that legislation out to the public, educate the public on it, so that when we go to Washington, then legislators would not water it down outside of the public view. And that is where we are standing right now. We are in the process of launching that national campaign to educate the public at large, sea to shining sea, about this legislation and why it is so crucial that it be enacted.
Something interesting that you stated about some of the pushback from some of the staffers of these congressional reps or other people, That just seems very troubling. Why would they, did they give any reason to why they said, well, don't bring me legislation with penalties in it? I mean, they're always passing legislation with penalties in it. Unfortunately, the people being penalized by that legislation are, of course, the victims of racism and white supremacy, 21st century slavery and human trafficking. So did they give any indication of why? I mean, did they say something like, oh, well, it'll be difficult to pass because, you know, they got, the police unions are very strong in this country, and they donate a lot of money, or they have a lot of influence in the legislative process, and we just don't think we could, you know, get it passed. So, I mean, what are some of the excuses that they gave, if any, that you have heard?
The excuses that I've heard for the legislation is that it's too much.
Too much.
Mm-hmm. Because it's very detailed, and mm-hmm. it contains a lot of caveats that have previously probably never been incorporated in legislation. But we don't care about that because the problem is we've had a problem of people being killed for centuries again, and nothing has been done about it. So there's no such thing as going too far. If it's a reasonable, a sound solution to a problem, then we expect them to adopt it. So that was number one. The other was one representative's office was concerned we had taken it public and that maybe he wouldn't be able to get the credit for the legislation. Mm. So what we're seeing is that our many elected officials, their agenda differs from ours, and we've never made them feel that our agenda is their agenda. And so we are seeing, I guess, the ramifications of allowing elected officials to stay in Washington for decades and never really serve us, because if they had been, we would not have the problems that we're currently experiencing in our communities.
Now, an example of a legislation without penalty that this legislation that you are proposing in the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act, you all call for a database to be created so that we can get reports of the police interaction with citizens, whether they kill someone. Well, just last week, you had U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch say that she does not support a federal mandate that requires police to report, because there already is federal law that came out in the 90s that says that police should, and that's the key word, should keep these statistics. But there again, it's no mandate. It's just a suggestion, which to me is, you know, if it was just going to be a suggestion, then you know, why did you need to pass legislation? Because, you know, you're not calling for any kind of penalties. Like, if you do not send in this statistical data to the Department of Justice or the FBI, whoever's in charge of keeping the statistics, then you will lose, for example, any federal funding that you may be getting. Whatnot. So, I mean, there has been legislation pushed in the past, but it was absent any kind of mandate or any kind of penalties. And as a result, now today you even got the FBI admitting that they are embarrassed. They are embarrassed that they don't have statistics. And they are being outdone by either members of the media or regular citizen journalists who have been keeping their own databases and whatnot. So, talk a little bit about creating a database that you call POP in the legislation. What would that consist of?
Well, today, the U.S. Department of Justice conducts these pattern and practice investigations. Mm-hmm. These are the investigations that occur after high-profile shootings, such as they did in the case of Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, etc. And they generally look at the individual behaviors of the officers as well as the collective behavior of the officers and their superiors in the form of looking at the agency. So it's sort of two concurrent investigations that occur. Mm-hmm. And what we find is that the investigations almost, I think they always, I haven't found an exception, they reveal that there's a pattern or practice of unconstitutional or behavior against certain segments, usually demographic segments, generally African Americans, Hispanics, by a policing department. And so all of that, though, that investigation, that's all retroactive. That's based on things that have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The POP data bank would capture data as it's happening.
Mm.
It would also analyze data as it's happening. So rather than having to go back and sift through files and interview people in order to put together a picture of how a particular officer is behaving with people, you can literally hit a button and get a secure report that will show you, oh, okay, this officer has a tendency to, people who are arrested by him seem to be bruised all the time.
Right.
People who are arrested by him seem to be African Americans ages 18 through 22. 10 of them have said that he planted contraband on them. These patterns will begin to emerge that will then allow people who are in control, and we have various controls within this legislation, but it would allow the people who have access to these controls to, in fact, determine if these officers are engaging in these unconstitutional patterns, and if they are, quickly remove them from the force. So rather than allowing people to engage in these behaviors and get more and more and more and more egregious in their actions, this data bank will allow us to remove them before they become embedded in their practices and begin taking lives, etc. And that's called the pattern or practice data bank. And that data bank would be, it's the only legislation to date that has presented legislative proposal that have called for the collection of data on an officer level, and that would allow for the immediate analysis of that data in order to identify patterns and practices for an individual law enforcement agent or private duty security officers, because they too fall under this act, as do people in personnel, law enforcement in prisons, law enforcement in juvenile institutions, any law enforcement agency in the country, this data bank applies to. And you can't work in law enforcement if you're not in this data bank.
It actually sounds similar to proposals or practices that I see law enforcement taking, like, you know, having a database. We could use Chicago, for example. Chicago, when you are arrested, you know, they enter you into this database and trying to figure out gang affiliations and stuff like that. And what these databases, what they are saying they are for, is to be able to predict, you know, crime and whatnot. Now, that sounds kind of like, you know, movie-ish. You know, I think they have, like, the movie Minority Report, where you had these precogs that were able to predict, you know, somebody was going to commit a crime or whatnot. And so you have law enforcement across this country that are already engaged in such things. And so this sounds like, you know, something similar on the flip side, though, of being able to predict the future crimes that will be committed against citizen, against law enforcement officers of any particular agency. Is that an accurate description?
Pretty accurate. The only thing I would add to it is that you're looking at their performance, their past performance, as a predictor of future performance. Mm-hmm. And if someone, just like in an employment situation, usually if you have someone who's having problems after problems after problems, then guess what? That is not probably the person you want to keep on your payroll, because unless there is some kind of intervention that occurs that can significantly alter that individual, that person is probably, if he can't perform, he or she can't perform. If the job is too difficult, he or she is just too difficult. So that in that way, you are absolutely correct. It does, in essence, it alerts the powers that be, it alerts the citizens to officers who are beginning to exhibit troubling patterns, and it allows for their expedient removal.
Mm-hmm. You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. Our guest today is Ms. Gerald Sanders. She is the president of Onus Inc., and we are talking about the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act. If you would like to ask a question, if you have a comment or observation, please give us a call, 641-715-3660, participant code 549-032 pound. Again, hit *6-1 if you want to come in on air. You can also call us at 704-951-5030. Again, the studio line is 704-951-5030. We're going to take a short station identification break and continue our discussion with Ms. Sanders. You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com. And we are back. Thank you again, Ms. Sanders, for sharing some of your time with us today to inform us about this very important piece of legislation that ONUS is proposing. The next question that I have, one of the things that stands out to me under the area where it's talking about creating transparency, but there is a bullet point in here that says deputizes licensed attorneys and gives them the power to act on behalf of the Department of Justice to prosecute abuse of law enforcement agencies and agents. And so just, you know, play devil's advocate here. Wouldn't, let's say, possible detractors say, well, that's what we got prosecutors for. That's what we got state attorneys for. So can you tell us, you know, what does these deputized licensed attorneys look like? How do they get appointed to that position? And, you know, I'm not going to even ask you the stupid question of why we can't leave it in the hands of prosecutors and state attorneys, because, you know, it's evident that they are not interested in practicing justice. So what would that area look like in deputizing licensed attorneys? How would an attorney qualify?
Well, if you are a licensed attorney, you would qualify.
Okay,
so the family would have the authority, the family or the community member would find the attorney of their choosing, and they would select him or her to act on their behalf. Now, there must be an education process as part of this, because many attorneys today, just black, white, you know, Hispanic, they do not serve their clients' interests. So there's a process that we would have to engage in as a community to begin to hold people accountable, attorneys, for actually carrying through on what it is that we hire them to do. But back to the law. What it does is, it is the Department of Justice has, there are 1,800 law enforcement agencies in the country, and in the 5 years prior to Michael Brown's killing, DOJ had conducted 20 pattern or practice investigations. That was 4 per year. Every one that I've yet been able to investigate revealed problem patterns, problem practices. So clearly, if DOJ was only able to conduct 20 investigations in 5 years, and there are more than 1,800 local law enforcement agencies, then DOJ simply does not have the power to police the police.
Yes, the manpower. So, yes.
Exactly. So what we've done is we've enlarged and expanded DOJ's personnel arsenal by the number of attorneys who would be prepared. We would require that they be trained, okay, trained in order to carry out the DOJ functions. In other words, related to the pattern or practice investigation. If there's a, if for example, we say, hey, there's a problem in this community, yet DOJ says, hey, that's not important enough to us to look at. We hire an attorney. That attorney then acts on behalf of DOJ, begins to look at these reports, does the investigation, and then can file suit against the agency, can file suit against law enforcement agents as if standing in place of DOJ.
Now, are we talking civil lawsuits or are we talking criminal?
They would be both.
Okay.
It would be both. In other words, DOJ brings criminal actions against individual police officers who deprive people of their constitutional rights. That's a violation of their authority. And then it brings civil actions against law enforcement agencies. But so this person, these law enforcement agents, as agents of DOJ, can bring both civil and criminal law enforcement actions against law enforcement agents and law enforcement agencies.
Now, we do a program on Black Talk Radio Network called New Abolitionist Radio, which is our media outreach to the public concerning 21st century slavery and human trafficking. And we started doing a series every week because it's a weekly program. But the people involved in the production of that program started doing a series called Ferguson is America, where we start looking at each and every state, not just a city, but we look at the state and we identify information that's already been put out there, any investigations already done, whether that is by quote unquote authorities, state, you know, attorneys, whether it's the DOJ ever got involved, or, you know, if it's just media reports. And what we try to do is establish a pattern and practice case against these individual states. But here's one of the things that we found as we covered the Ferguson report, which identified patterns and practices of unconstitutional violations, or constitutional violations, I should say. But the thing that disturbed us the most is that you compiled all this information. You even said in the Ferguson report that there were criminal violations, but yet there were no criminal prosecutions. And so what we're saying is, if there is not going to be any kind of criminal prosecutions, look, we've been getting these pattern and practices reports that I know of. The first one I saw was from the 1970s in Philadelphia. And, you know, that usually leads to what do they call that, where that department, police department, is put under Department of Justice.
A consent agreement.
Yeah.
Consent agreement.
Yes, a consent decree. Decree, right. Agreement, yes. But it doesn't lead to any improvement at all that I have seen. No improvements whatsoever. So we say then, you know, well, this is just a lot of wasted money and manpower if you're going to do all these investigations and there's never any criminal prosecutions. In your research, have you ever seen where these have led to criminal prosecutions in a pattern and practice investigation?
There are some instances out there where they have succeeded in that.
Okay.
But the here's what we have to do. You have to look at the entire process. And because DOJ has a very hard road to, there's a high bar. You have to show that someone willfully intended to violate a person's constitutional right, okay, in order to indict them on criminal charges, at least DOJ does. So part of the, in doing that, a lot of that has to do with the creation of the story as a result of the collection of evidence after a killing or after brutality. And so what you have is, the problem you have is that the CSIs, everyone who's collecting the information from the crime scene, be it a case of a killing or a case of extreme brutality where the victim didn't die, but the problem is that the law enforcement controls the entire chain of custody after the event. They control everything. So they can change and make these minor adjustments that literally make it impossible for DOJ or others to convict an officer, given that there's such a broad latitude that the law allows law enforcement agents. Well, we've also dealt with that. Okay. In the second piece of the legislation, which has to deal with the obligation to preserve life and prevent injury. No longer is the investigative process involving where there's an allegation of force against an officer or where the officer is alleging that someone did something to him or her, no longer would those be investigated, would those incidents be investigated by law enforcement agents. Those would be independent investigative teams that are exist beforehand, who have very strict protocols and processes for managing evidence and for investigating the incident. So what we've done is we've separated the fact-finding process from the decision-making process. And once that independent team finds the facts, they bring it before a grand jury, and there's no prosecutor involved in that process.
Right. I was just reading that it would empower the independent investigative team, not the public prosecutor, with the responsibility to present evidence to a public grand jury. I think that's very important. If we, again, look back at Ferguson, the killing of Michael Brown, I should say the murder of Michael Brown, I think, and not just him, even in the case of John Crawford III, who was gunned down in a Walmart while holding an airsoft rifle, you know, even though he wasn't engaged in any kind of illegal activity, but we see both prosecutors who sort of manipulated the process to get the outcome that they wanted. And so I think that is very important in what is being proposed here, is that you can create an investigative team that is totally independent of the prosecutor's office as well as the law enforcement agencies that might be called in to investigate.
Absolutely.
Let's see. Also, let me just scan down. Requires U.S. Attorney General to create an Office of Civilian Oversight and Accountability. Is this similar? Would this be similar, for example, to any other civilian oversight boards that we see in other municipalities, like New York Police Department, for example? The I can't recall the officer's name, but the one who has been found guilty of committing excessive force by the Civilian Review Board against James Blake, the former tennis pro, a very high profile case, even though I haven't seen that much published about it here recently. But the problem I saw with that was that, well, hell, this same cop had four or five previous complaints lodged against him by the with the same Civilian Review Board. So the common complaint that I hear from a lot of people in relation to these civilian review boards is that they don't have any real power.
Well, the civilian oversight body we're talking about would be there would be no structure, okay? And when I say no structure, we don't want people jockeying for political position and all of that inside of this body. Mm-hmm. It would almost be virtual. In essence, they would hold four conferences a year, and during those conferences, there would be committees that convene in a virtual way. So they would convene to do work, all of the people that decide to come to this conference, and then when the conference is over, those committees dissolve. And then there's another a regional conference. But the point is the work will be instrumental in deciding and changing policies and improving practices. In other words, the goal is to have so many citizens routinely involved in this process, mm-hmm. and attending these conventions, mm-hmm. that they influence policy and continuously improve policing in this country by bringing forth during a conference new policies, new approaches to policing, highlighting problems and coming and identifying what kinds of solutions they want addressed, what problems they want addressed. So this body would be strong because of the participants, and because of the fact that they have the ability, based upon this law, to influence policing and the tactics. For example, tactics that police want to employ, they have to come before this body before they are allowed to implement those, like putting their knee in your neck or those mm-hmm. kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So that's why we felt that this body would be very important in helping to ensure that there's flexibility as well in this process, because we know that the police unions and fraternal orders will get busy as soon as this legislation is enacted, trying to figure out a way to undermine it.
One of the most important things that I see in this legislation, just aside from prosecution of killer cops, is getting them removed before they killed. If an officer shows a pattern practice of brutality, I will guarantee you that eventually is going to escalate to where he kills someone. All right, or she kills someone. If they have all these complaints against them of beating people and excessive force, it's only a matter of time, in my opinion, before they actually kill someone. And so part of the accountability that on the website, it says that would address this would allow for the speedy removal of law enforcement agencies deemed unfit. And so this seeks, in my opinion, this seeks to nullify the protections that unfit officers have received through police unions, who are very powerful and have been able to successfully get policies in place that, for example, a cop doesn't have to speak to the internal affairs investigative team for 24 to 48 hours. That gives them time to, you know, piece together some lies and whatnot and paint a scenario that's favorable to them. Whereas if you look at an investigation of someone else, a regular citizen who has been accused of committing a crime, well, you know, there is no such, you know, well, we can't talk to you for 24 hours or 48 hours. We're going to give you time, you know, to get your thoughts together about what really happened. And so, yeah, I think that is a very important part of it. Can you talk about that?
Yes, this bill, first of all, is federal. In most of those LEBOR, Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, most of those are enacted, in fact, at the state level.
Okay.
And so by this merely being federal legislation, it was superseded. But also, we believe that restricting an officer's ability to speak for a certain period of time is actually a violation of their right to free speech, even though we know they probably embrace that idea.
Right.
It's still nonetheless a violation of the right to free speech. So what this law does is it actually would negate LEBOR's, the law enforcement, at least the 10-day rule. It's usually 10 days. It would negate the 10-day rules in all of the state, and it would require officers to submit to interviews within hours after a use of force event.
Wait a minute, back up. You mean to tell me they don't have to talk to an investigator for 10 days?
Right. It's called the 10-day rule in many states. So they have 10 days, like 10 days, and they don't have to. In fact, not they don't have to. They can. And so the fact that they, quote, can't is a violation of the freedom to speech. So this law would negate that rule.
I mean, that is a clear impediment to, you know, an investigation. That's just crazy. That's crazy. I had heard 24 to 48 hours. I did not know it was a 10-day rule. So thank you for sharing that information. I think that's very important. Tamir Rice, I want to bring up Tamir Rice because we recently just got some new news related to his murder, where you had the officers just drive up on this young man in a public park where he was playing. He was just standing under a gazebo by himself, and they just ran the car up right to where he was at. Timothy Lohman, one of the officers involved, and I'm speaking of the Cleveland Police Department, jumps out before the car even stops, and under 2 seconds he has fired fatal shots and hit Tamir Rice, who would later succumb to his serious injuries and die. And so, this person, Timothy Lohman, had been dismissed from a police department, a small town police department, where he had gotten very poor performance reviews and whatnot. I mean, some of the people that was involved in that, his performance review said he was very immature and said he shouldn't even have a gun. But he was able to travel to Cleveland and get another job. And so this legislation would address that, would it not? The ability of an officer to leave one place and go to another and get another job doing the same thing?
It absolutely does. It's called the unfit indicator. And if a person in an authoritative role or police oversight role identifies a law enforcement agent as being unfit to serve, then that unfit indicator is set in the data bank, and then that law enforcement agent can never work in law enforcement or as a private duty security officer again in the United States. Now, that is after due process mechanism. You know, you always have the right to due process. But certainly, if a person in authority says this guy's unfit, then guess what? That unfit indicator is set until that issue is resolved.
Yeah, and in the case of Timothy Lohman, he was actually terminated. So, yeah, I agree. What sense does it make, you know, for these people to get terminated from one job or being forced to resign and then they just travel across the country? I mean, I've seen that several times where that has happened. Let me see. Here's something that I like that it also addresses. Provides for unscheduled in-the-field inspections of law enforcement agents in their vehicles to detect throwdown weapons and contraband. Now, I imagine that contraband refers to drugs or illegal substances that they arrest people for, because we have heard the stories. We have actually seen videos of police officers planting drugs on people as they search their vehicles and whatnot. So can you speak a little bit about that? That I have never heard of anyone propose such a thing, and I think it is a very constructive suggestion that addresses a very real issue.
You know, I'm often reminded of that scene in Training Day. In fact, it's out on our website, where Denzel pumps his chest and says, "I'm King Kong," and he says, I think he says, "Nobody has nothing on me," or something like that he says. But the bottom line is, when these law enforcement agents are in the field, they have their guns, they have their badges, they have their blue suits, and literally, they lord over the population. And many plant contraband, they take money, they do all manner of things, some of them do, and it's just business as usual. Well, with this data bank, if someone alleges that a law enforcement agent planted contraband, the chances are that agent won't do that one time. That's going to be a practice. Mm-hmm. He or she will evidence that kind of behavior over a period of time. And when that agent is found to, those kinds of complaints come in, then there will be a team that is charged with there's a very strict process by which this team will operate, and they can essentially stop a vehicle in the field. Basically, no one would know ahead of time, by the way, mm-hmm. which officer they were going to inspect or which vehicle they were going to inspect. It would be determined right there sitting in the car with everyone looking, because that data bank is accessible in that way and can make the selection, the data bank will. Mm-hmm. And they will find out. By the way, we're calling for GPS on all these cars. Okay, you don't know where police cars are, right? FedEx has GPS. Every trucking company just about in the United States now has GPS, where you can determine where vehicles are. With law enforcement, they can go anywhere they want to go. They can go to the drug house, visit the girlfriend, do whatever they want to do on paid time, and we don't know where they are. So these vehicles would be able to be tracked. They would go to the vehicle, announce an inspection is underway. And by the way, before the officer leaves the station, every day they do a check. They, both officers or whoever's in that vehicle does an inspection of that vehicle. They inspect the vehicle, they inspect each other to make sure my partner has no contraband so that if I get stopped, I'm not charged with something my partner has. Mm-hmm. So they inspect each other. And then once they're out in the field, this team stops them, announces an inspection's underway, they get to search a vehicle, they get to search your officers.
That's great. That's great. I think that would, that's a preventive measure, actually. That's a preventive measure. And prevention, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as they say. So I had never heard anybody propose such a thing, and I think it's just wonderful that you all included that. As we get ready to wrap up the interview, I do want to take it back to the database. Because, again, Attorney Loretta Lynn, the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynn, has broken with her predecessor, Attorney General Eric Holder, who said that absolutely, you know, these law enforcement departments should be recording these statistics and reporting them to the Department of Justice. Well, she's saying she doesn't support a federal mandate. And one of the reasons that she gave for not supporting the mandate is she said that there's an issue with manpower. She said some of these small police departments may have only 50 employees, and so therefore that will present a challenge and or whatnot in them reporting it. And we don't want to tell them how to do their reporting or get in the minutia of all of that, but we do suggest to them that they do file these statistics. So what do you think in terms of how difficult would it be to implement a national database like the ones that you are proposing to track pattern and practices, POP?
Well, literally the specifications are almost within the legislation. Many years ago, I had responsibility for designing a major system inventory, multiple systems for AT&T, mm-hmm. To track $200 million investment of inventory. I have documented countless systems when my firm was rewriting the taxpayer notices for Internal Revenue Service. We had a very strong understanding of the integration of systems and how they operate. So a system like that would only be limited by its software. And when you think about the data that this nation is collecting right now on citizens alone, mm-hmm. okay, mm-hmm. every day, NSA and FBI, all of the data banks in this nation that are being used to track people and citizens and phone records and all of this other data. Also, right now, we collect data on every law enforcement agent who is killed, okay? So if law enforcement feels it's important to track and capture data on law enforcement agents killed, why isn't it important to capture data on the people that law enforcement encounters and brutalizes and kills, et cetera? So I beg to differ with Ms. Lynch. I would think that I have certainly been, probably have a much deeper understanding of that topic than she does, given my background. And I also say that blacks in this nation have been experiencing these kinds of problems for over 200 years, okay? We've been being killed and lynched and shot down. And I don't care what resources are required to bring an end to this. We go to the moon when we want. We part waters when we want and build tunnels under the ocean. Man does what man wants. It's time that we get this problem resolved, and I don't care what the resource requirements are.
Mm-hmm. Finally, we want to talk about the campaign, the marketing campaign to educate the public about this legislation. How can anyone listening to the program now or perhaps listening to it later, how can we assist in this campaign to educate the public about the Uniform Reporting Law Enforcement Improvement Act?
Okay, first of all, we need people to sign up on our at our website. You can go to our website, and you can click on the About Us, and you'll see Stay Connected. So you can put your information in there so we can contact you. This is the most important thing at this juncture, is we need you to sign up. You can also sign up by sending information to your telephone number, your name, and your email address. You can just send that information to info@changesonus.org. If you're not on the internet, you can just call us and leave your information and say, I want to be a part of this. And you can reach us at 202-817-1331. That's 202-817-1331. We need you to join our conference call this Saturday. We will have some retired law enforcement agents on. We will have some parents of mothers and fathers of children who have been killed by police officers. Now, let me tell you when that is. It's at 1 o'clock Central Time. That's 1 p.m. Central Time this coming Saturday. It's 12 noon Mountain Time, 11 Pacific Time. So that's 11 Pacific Time, 12 Mountain Time, 1 o'clock Central Time, and 2 o'clock Eastern Time. Okay, we need you to call. Here's how you get onto the call. You dial 641-715-3580. That's 641-715-3580. And then you enter the access code, which is 127-572. 127-572. We also need, if you're an organization and you're listening to my voice, send us your intent to be supportive of this legislation. Say, we endorse this legislation. Give us the name of your group, the telephone number, email address, and we will put you on our website as one of the people, organizations endorsing this legislation. And I'll conclude with this. We can't get this done without you. We know that. We need your help. We need your active support. We also need you, if you've got $1, $2, $3, $100, $1,000, go to our website and donate. We need money to run this campaign, but we need your help. Change is on us, and we can get this done if we all just say, we don't care. We're going to invest enough to get this done.
Again, the website is changeisonus.org. Again, changeisonus.org. And again, I want to thank you, Ms. Sanders, for the great work that you and your team is involved in bringing real solutions, concrete proposals to address the myriad of issues that we face. But I feel like one of the most important issues or most dire threats to our communities are police terrorism, and this bill does a lot to address those issues. So thank you again. Thank your team. And did you have any final thoughts to leave with the listeners?
Just thank you so much for having me on. Certainly we would love to come back. I'd love to come back on and update you as we move throughout this process. But I can tell everyone that on that conference call on Saturday, that's when we will begin to release some marching orders that everyone, some steps that everyone can immediately begin to take to let this nation know and to let those who are in power know that no longer are we going to tolerate our children being gunned down in the streets.
Thank you, Ms. Sanders. You have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And once again, you're listening to Black Talk Radio News, airing right here on the Black Talk Radio Network. Check us out every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. We are in the second half of today's program. I will be going over the usual hour that I have been going over the past couple of weeks, because I do want to get into the Justice or Else rally that was held over the weekend. Specifically, I would like to review the words of Minister Farrakhan, who spoke for over 2 hours, so we won't be able to get to all of it or get through the entire speech today, but certainly I will get to the rest of what we are not able to cover during the rest of this week and even next week if we have to. All right, so if you have any comments, any questions, please give us a call, 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549032 pound. Again, that's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549032 pound. Hit *6 and 1 to comment on air. But we right now we're going to take a message music break, and then we'll come back. We will listen to the first portion of Minister Farrakhan's Justice or Else speech.
Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
When we see our people being brutalized by white bigots, white racists, we think that they are foolish to allow themselves to be beaten and brutalized and do nothing whatsoever to protect themselves. They are foolish. They should have the right to defend themselves against any attack made against them by anyone. If a dog is biting a black man, the black man should kill the dog. Whether the dog is a police dog, a hound dog, or any kind of dog. If a dog is sick on a black man, when that black man is doing nothing but trying to take advantage of what the government says is supposed to be his, then that black man should kill that dog or any two-legged dog, two-legged dog, two-legged dog. Wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, as other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to, has to bring an end to, has to bring an end
to. And welcome back. You're tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. This is Scotty Reed in for this broadcast from behind these enemy lines. So this is the way that I'm going to do this, okay? Let's play about 30 minutes of the speech. I encourage people to take notes or whatever. I'm certainly going to take notes, and we just want to analyze the speech to see if we get any constructive suggestions made, anything that we can implement either individually or as a group, so that we can get the boot of the oppressor off of our neck. Now, before I get into that, let me say this. Malcolm X is my primary teacher when it comes to racism and white supremacy, and studying his teachings and reviewing all the lectures and stuff. Nobody has taught me more than listening to the things that he has spoken about on that. But he has always evolved, as all humans should evolve as they get a little older. They should be getting a little wiser because they get more experience. And so therefore, you know, as you get more experience, then therefore you can better address the problems that you are working on. But pertaining to that last clip, I'll be, 48 this year, 47, 48 this year. I have learned since in my early 20s or whatnot, in the last 20, 25 years, that it is impossible for us to get 100% unity. Indeed, that's not possible in any community. People say things like, well, the Hispanics, they all stick together, and these white people all stick together. That's just not true. That is just not true. Anytime you have individuals with different backgrounds, different experiences, different realities and whatnot, then, you know, you're just not going to be able to get everyone on the same page. That's just unrealistic goal. All right. But what the goal should be is to get as many of the same thinking, right thinking people who agree on certain aspects, get enough of them together, and you can indeed make a tremendous impact. Indeed, you can bring about revolution, which is change. Some of the other elders that I have spoken to have told me that in any time, like, for example, in Africa, any region of Africa, any nation in Africa that was fighting for its independence back in the 1950s, early 1960s, only 5% of the total population ever engaged in any kind of revolutionary activities aimed at gaining independence from colonial powers. All right. So with that said, I just want to say that I am not looking to unify with everybody. All right. I just think that's an impossible goal. I'm just looking to work with whoever is working against the system of racism and white supremacy. And, you know, as long as you're doing that, then we're working towards the same goal. Then we certainly can coordinate our efforts. As I have stated, you know, you need to open up several different fronts in a war. On any battlefield, you have several fronts. There's not just one, let's say, you know, battle line there. You get on this side, I get on this side, and we're just going to shoot at each other. No, you try to open up as many fronts as possible in a war so that you can stretch the resources of your enemy so that he overextends himself, and then you can exploit the weaknesses. You can exploit the cracks in his defenses. All right. So with that said, you know, again, you know, 100% unity in any community is impossible. But again, you can take 5% of any population and make tremendous change. All right. You can do a lot of damage, you know, to your enemies. All right. So let's go ahead and cue up this video. Minister Farrakhan, and let's just review his speech. Before I do that, though, just to let you know, more live streaming scheduled for tonight on Black Talk Radio Network. Tando Radio show, it will be coming on at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. I think that is a very important show on the network, as not only do they talk about global events, current events, things like that. But they also talk a lot about preparedness. You know, some people might know preparedness by the name or the term prepping, you know, and usually that's associated with white people. And then also, it also has a connotation to it, a negative connotation to it, that, you know, the mainstream media likes to paint people who are engaged in prepping as, you know, conspiracy theorists or, you know, crazy people and whatnot, and, you know, building bomb shelters and stockpiling weapons and food and all of that. And you know what? Given the instability that exists on this planet, I think it's the exact opposite. I think you're crazy if you are not preparing to the best of your ability for the eventuality of any emergency, whether that be a man-made emergency or a natural disaster. You should be preparing the best that you can. All right, so Tando Radio Show, 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Black Talk Radio Network. All right, let's go ahead and cue up the speech, and we will listen to about 30 minutes of the speech given by Farrakhan. Again, it's over 2 hours long, so we will do future broadcasts this week and analyzing the different portions of the speech.
God has put in his mouth to speak, and it will never take a fearless people, a people who are afraid of the enemy. When we demand justice, it takes strength and courage. This is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, a man given to us by God himself. Let us receive the man of the hour, the man of this time. He is the national representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Please receive. The cause of freedom and justice for over 60 years. God has blessed us with the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. I hate being behind this glass. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, we give him praise and thanks for all of his prophets and the scriptures which they brought. We thank him for Moses and the Israelite prophets that gave us the Torah, or the Old Testament. We thank him for Jesus, who gave us the Injil, or the Gospel, and the apostles that gave us what is called the New Testament. We thank him for Muhammad ibn Abdullah, through whom the last revelation to humanity before the judgment of this present world, that book is called the Holy Quran. I am a student of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, And I could never thank Allah enough for His merciful intervention in our affairs in the person of Master Fard Muhammad, the great Mahdi, who is in the world and is championing the liberation struggle of our people, particularly in the United States of America. I greet all of you, my dear and wonderful brothers and sisters, with the greeting words of peace. We say it in the Arabic language, Assalamu alaikum. First, I want to say to all of you, I am honored beyond words to be here standing on this rostrum in front of this hallowed building, in front of I don't know how many, I'm not going to guess, but I thank Almighty God Allah for every single one of you that decided to answer the call to demand justice or else. I watched the program in my hotel room, and I want to say how happy I am to be a part of such a great showing of unity of the Aboriginal people of our planet. I want our Native American family and Brother Night Wolf, I'm sorry that they cut you a little short, but I want you to know how favored you are as a Native American giant standing for his people. The Native people who came in their Native dress, this is not like going to a football game with the Redskins. They are not here as some mascot. They are here because they are the original owners of this part of the earth, and we honor them with the honor that they are justly due. Their suffering in their land is very great. So all of those who cry for justice, no cry is greater than those who have suffered the most. And those who have suffered the most are the indigenous people, not only of America, but of the Western Hemisphere, and those of us who were brought into America not as pilgrims, not as Puritans, not seeking another way of worship, but in the holds of ships, to be made the burden bearers of the real citizens of America. It's hypocritical for us to say that we are citizens and we are still trying to get civil rights while at the same time we are denied the human right of self-determination. I'm honored to be here in front of this great, great house that was built by black slaves. So I don't think I'm encroaching with the sweat of our ancestors. I'm honored to be here and am grateful to Congressman Danny Davis for having shepherded through both houses a joint resolution that allows us to be on the Capitol steps. I was so by our Native brothers and sisters and our Hispanic brothers and sisters and some who are black may say, Farrakhan, why are you talking to all of these different ethnicities? We have to accept our position. I loved my sister and those standing with her who championed the call that Black Lives Matter. I felt so happy to see her and to hear her and to know and for her to know that she and Black Lives Matter are welcome, have a cherished spot because they represent the future leadership. These are not just young people who happened to wake up one morning. Ferguson ignited it all. So all the brothers and sisters from Ferguson, all the brothers and sisters that laid in the streets, all the brothers and sisters that challenged the tanks, we are honored that you have come to represent our struggle and our demand. Again, I'm grateful for the choir that sung and the brothers and sister that sang, for Brother Rasul Muhammad and his wonderful song that he wrote about the great liberator Emiliano Zapata, and to all of you who made this day so far what it is. Every member of the clergy that prayed this morning, the Muslims, the various prayers that were said, the native people who have their native places, their teepees and whatnot on the grounds, they're sacred people. And they deserve justice. And we, in unity, will not only get justice for ourselves, but justice for all those who are deprived of that precious essential of life itself. On this beautiful mall, which was a slave center hundreds of years ago, right here, down this mall, there used to be slave pens. And in that movie, 12 Years a Slave, the black brother was brought here, down on the my left side, your right side, in a little yellow house where he was severely beaten before he was sent off to be a slave unjustly for 12 years. I feel the cry of our ancestors, the pain of those on whose shoulders we stand. I feel that the ancestors are happy that a young generation has arisen. I saw the faces of the young in line trying to come in, and they made it, I guess, safe, but they made it difficult. But the young stood in their place until they could get in, because that's who we work for. We who are getting older, and I'm speaking now of myself and my generation, what good are we if we don't prepare young people to carry the torch of liberation to the next step? What good are we if we think we can last forever and not prepare others to walk in our footsteps? So to the young that are here, we honor you. We know who you are, and we will not forsake our duty to you. There are some elders that are not worthy to pass on the legacy of their cowardice to our young people. Our young people will not listen to those made in America, made by America, and want to bow down in America to that which has given them hell. These young people are looking for fearless leadership, but leadership that cannot be bought. Leadership that is willing to sacrifice its life to see a better future for our children. I'm honored that my brother and friend, Father Flager, is here, who is a great fighter in Chicago. I'm honored that Quorum Master Barry is here, and I thank Allah for her and her dear departed husband, who really showed us the way. For all of you who want to sacrifice in some way to make a difference, there can be no freedom, no justice, no equity without the willingness of some to sacrifice for the rest. What good is life if we're not free? What good is it to be alive and every day that you live, you see your people suffering? What good is it to be continue in life under tyranny? So there must come a time when we say enough is enough. It must change, and I am willing to do whatever it takes to bring about that change. I thank Allah for Brother Makandal from Haiti and Brother Vladimir from the Dominican Republic, two great brothers that Islam has brought together, but the machinations of white supremacy is trying Haiti and the Dominican Republic used to be called Hispaniola. And it's the first place that the wicked one, Columbus, set his feet. Tomorrow, they say it's his birthday. I think it's tomorrow or the day after. Monday. But no indigenous people want to celebrate. A man who came and dislodged them. A man who came seeking a new route to India and ended up in America. And when they saw the original people that they saw, well, they must be Indians. Because we white folk don't make mistakes like that. But they're not just Indians, nor are we African Americans. We were here before a continent named Africa was named. We were certainly here before America's Vespucius, and this part of the world was named after him. So we don't diminish ourselves by naming ourselves after Johnny Come Latelys. We are the aboriginal people of our planet, and before there was a planet, we were here with God in the beginning. Black woman, you are not the second self of man alone. You are the second self of God. And as the second self of God, any man that would disrespect a female is an enemy of God. Because she is the greatest gift from God to a man. May I pause for a moment and say to women, your language must change as to how you address yourselves. You should never call another woman a bitch. Get that word out of our language. No female is after a dog. Every female is after God. So all of you black men that like to use such words, pull it out of your tongue before your tongue is pulled out of your head. Every woman is from the Creator. Her womb is the workshop of God. So when a man sees a woman, he should bow in honor to her. The Native Americans can teach us much in the respect of women. I've been up on the reservations. I've been in the Anipi. I've been to some of their ceremonies. And the native people, the men, draw blood, hanging from trees and carrying skulls of animals in dirt attached to the flesh of their back in tremendous pain until the flesh snaps and blood pours out. The native people do that to pay honor to the woman, for she is in labor, enduring the pain of death to bring forth new life. And there's always a show of blood before the birth. So the man is trying to equal himself up to the woman. That means that the native man who disrespects your female, you have lost your way. And any black man under the sound of our voice, any red man, any yellow man that will traffic in women and girls, you are worthy of death itself. Now,
all right, we're going to stop it there as we have a little less than 20 minutes left in the program. Let me just mark the spot where we left off so we can pick back up later this week. And I do believe we have a caller online. Let me see if that caller's still on, and I'll go to them and see if they have any questions or comments, any observations they would like to share. Area code 267, you are on live. Go ahead with your question or comment. Area code 267, are you still with us? Okay, it appears they must have hung up. All right. Okay. All right, let me check the other phone lines. Okay, we do have some people on the other line. Area code 973. You may want to hang up and call us back because you are in twice. Your number's showing up twice, and therefore that's why we're getting all that feedback. Sometimes that conference line does that. Give me just a second. Let me see if I can resolve it myself before you hang up. Hold on.
Q&A queue is cleared.
Okay, let's try it this way. Yeah, you seem to be dialed in twice, area code 97.
Okay, I'm going to call back in.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes that conference line might do that. Not really a lot to talk about in terms of what we just heard, but I did take some notes. And again, you know, I don't like talking about religion too much, and you know, people practice what they practice, but I feel like we have to set aside those religions and whatnot when we are looking to create a consensus or some type of unity around a single issue. We should leave those things at the door. Let me see. I think we okay. No, we're gonna wait for her to call back. If you once you call in, back in, sis, just hit *6 and 1, *6 and 1, and that'll bring you back on. The Aboriginal participation, the Native Americans, Hispanic participation. Minister Farrakhan addressed that. He said some people was asking a question. Okay, sis, I see you. Give me just a second. Let me finish up my statement, and I'll come back to you. First of all, a lot of African descendant people in this land behind these enemy lines known as USA Inc. There are no pure Africans here. We all, as victims of racism and white supremacy, have different lineage in our blood. But we also prior, you know, Africans and indigenous tribes or Indians, they have engaged in trade prior to Columbus coming here, and the Africans actually settled this land. You know, if you read the research of many different people, but I have heard a lot of people criticize and ask the question about, you know, bringing these other people into the struggle. It's not about bringing them into any kind of struggle, because they already in a struggle against racism and white supremacy. All non-white people, in fact, are and I'm saying that in general terms and excluding proxy racist tools, but most non-white people across the globe are being oppressed by racist white supremacists, and they are involved in struggle. Now, I think, you know, the question needs to be asked. I think we can I think we could accurately state that is, should we be aligning ourselves with other people? Well, my thoughts on that is, looking at it from a military perspective, I have not seen a modern war where either side did not have allies. Again, this goes to something I said towards the beginning, prior to playing that segment of the speech, about opening up different war fronts against the enemy so that you can stretch his resources, make him weak, and exploit those weaknesses. So I ain't got nothing against working with anybody who is sincerely struggling to overthrow this racist white supremacy system. Malcolm X, prior to his death, of course, we know he went through all out throughout Africa in the Arab world seeking allies on in the United Nations to make them see that our struggle was the same against the same common oppressor, the racist white male. And so, again, I don't got a problem with that. I understand that some people do. That's their right. Nobody should tell them who they should work with. I certainly don't let people tell me who I should work with. But just in the context of him welcoming those different people to participate, I didn't have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with it. I am also of indigenous blood. If not for my indigenous ancestors, who knows where my family might be, you know, because we were the lucky ones able to hang on to some of that land that was passed down to us. So I didn't have a problem with that. But so I'll leave my comments there. Area code 267, you were on first, but you got disconnected. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hey, good afternoon, Scotty.
What's brother up, Brother Ralph?
Hey, I'm fine, man. And I heard the replay of that sermon, because that's what it was. It was a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of felt for the people that spent precious money to go do that gathering down there, get hotel rooms, to listen to that. I mean, you know, we already know, most of us know, and I think most of the people that gathered at that mall knew yesterday, we ain't getting justice. This country has showed us time and time again. They're not going to give no, this is a capitalist country. They tell you it's a capitalist country, and they even have both houses, which they call themselves conservative, meaning I ain't giving up nothing. So, you know, I don't know why. And I went to the first Million Man March in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a emotional uplifting to see all those black men coming together for something positive.
Okay.
But I walked away from that sermon, and I'm going to tell you exactly what it was, sermon. I walked away from that sermon feeling empty again also. So, you know, I watched the whole thing. I said I was going to, like, take a look at it. Mm-hmm. I was going to, like, really. And I was waiting for the or else. And I never heard it. Okay. I never heard no direction. All I heard was a feel-good sermon, biblical. And like you said, Scotty, you know, this religious stuff got to go. Malcolm said if it was doing us any good, we wouldn't be in the condition we're in.
Right.
So that religious nonsense got to go. And far as, and I saw it as proselytizing, because he's trying to clear his name. Like I didn't have nothing to do with Malcolm. Yet I've seen plenty of evidence that he was basically part of the hype. and angering those brothers to kill Malcolm.
He admitted to that, Brother Ralph. Somebody brought that up yesterday on Facebook, and I provided them with the link to the interview that he gave with one of Malcolm's children, one of the daughters, where he admitted to his role in stirring up hatred towards Malcolm X. I'm very familiar with his admitted role. It's not the evidence, so I need to look at evidence objectively. I mean, he pretty much stated it in that interview, his role in it.
And as far as the economical plan, Scotty, I'm a little bit older than you, but I came around in the 60s and the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And under Elijah Muhammad, the Nation of Islam had stores all throughout the black community. I mean, they had fish trucks. They were doing great far as black business.
Black infrastructure.
Once the Honorable Elijah Muhammad passed away, those stores disappeared. There are no stores, no economical structure under Minister Louis Farrakhan. I would love to see the stores in his under his regime open up, prospering like they were doing under Elijah Muhammad. I don't see it, brother. So you can't come to me and tell me about economics when I don't see it within your own organization.
Practice what
Matter
you
of fact,
preach.
That organization was good before he took it over. So I'm just going by my experience, man, not downing nothing, not really trying to be negative, but I'm only going on my experience. I'm stating facts. I used to belong to the Nation in the 80s, and they used to call Malcolm Little, and he was worthy of death and all that until Spike Lee put out that movie showing another side. Then all of a sudden they saw something. They used to call him Heads and Malcolm Little and worthy of death. He was a traitor. That movie. Under leadership, they changed their tone. They changed their tone. They backed down from all that rhetoric. So, man, I know we get older, we live and we grow, we make mistakes when we're younger, but don't sell me something that ain't real, man. And that or else, you know, those people went down there looking for the or else, majority of them, because they know this capitalist country bent on imperialism is not going to give them justice. They know that. Most of the people knew that. So they was looking for the or else. How can we gravitate to justice? And believe me, brother, that was just empty rhetoric. It was not presented to the people in any kind of way. So I didn't even want to hear what you was just playing because it disturbed me.
Mm-hmm.
It really made me. And I was feeling for the people who made that journey, because I talked to a couple of them when they were down there, and they were telling me, like, and for him to have extend the right hand of fellowship to the brown population, they ain't show up in big numbers because they side with the oppressor. They want to replace us in this capitalist system. They hate us just as much as the oppressor does. So I don't know why we keep extending our hand to fellowship to these other people when they've shown us they have a lot of disdain for us, just as much as this man does, and they side with him. So, you know, Dr. Claude Anderson said, when you start hearing any leader, Dr. Claude Anderson said this, when you hear any leader talking about black-brown coalition and all that other stuff, they're a traitor.
So do you feel I'm a traitor, Brother Ralph? Do you feel like I'm a traitor?
I believe you still have hope that you still have hope that this thing can work. But every time these people, they come in this country and they're benefiting from things that our folks done struggled for since we've been here. And then they don't give us no credit. They don't align themselves. You don't hear none of these people wanting to align with us. And if you do, let me know, because I see them aligning themselves with the oppressor, like Zimmerman and a whole bunch of other ones.
Now, I'm not talking about, and I do got another call, and we got Tando Radio Show coming up. Let me say this. Just like I was saying earlier, I don't know how much you heard from some of the elders that were involved with the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army that I have spoken with. They have told me that in any kind of revolutionary movement or actual shooting war, that only 5% of the people actually are revolutionaries. And so, right. Like I always say, I don't think that 100% unity is possible in the Black community.
It's not possible
because some people, Black people, do align themselves with the oppressor, and you know, are willing to accept.
And so do some of those allies.
And that's what
about.
I'm saying.
More
that's,
so them.
Yeah, that's
More
what
so
I was going
them.
To say. But I have come across individuals in organizations who I would put in the 5%. So I'm not looking for 100% unity with anyone, whether they be Black people, whether they be Hispanic people, whether they be indigenous people. I will know you by your works. I will know you by what you do. Now, if I see you out there engaging against the enemy, bringing harm to the enemy and not bringing harm to my community, then I can work with you. I can work with you. But in terms of, again, if I think there's going to be any kind of mass participation, again, you know, most of the people, I mean, excuse me, a very small minority of people in any nation have ever been revolutionaries and would shed blood to overthrow the oppressor. So, yeah, those are my thoughts on that. Yeah.
But I appreciate your program, Scotty, and I just
Thank
had
you.
To, like, give you my opinion of that
question off topic, and then I'm gonna go to my next caller as we get ready to prepare for Tando Radio Show. I was trying to pick up the stream last night for Time for Awakening Radio. I noticed y'all came on an hour late. That was fine, but
that was a replay also. You might have to get with Brother Elliot and help him out there, because I don't, you know, he waited to Sunday to try to straighten this thing out, and again, and we had a dynamite guest. We were supposed to advertise our event this weekend up in Philadelphia, but it never.
What y'all got going on in Philadelphia this week?
Okay, One in a Million Black Voters and Contributors, Professor Klingman, Cynthia McKinney, Chukwuma Yantar-Lumumba, Dr. Julius Garvey, who is the son of the Honorable Marcus Garvey.
Mm-hmm.
We're up there trying to strengthen our people economically, trying to come up with a plan to combat the beast. So that point blank, that's what we're doing.
We just had one of y'all people on.
We're trying to find that small percentage of conscious people that want change, Scotty.
Okay.
You know what I mean? That's what we're looking for.
So y'all do got an event coming up, though, right? It's going to be weekend?
This Friday. This Friday, this October 16th, and Saturday, October 17th from 9 to 5, is going to be in Darby, Pennsylvania. It's going to be at the Abundant Life Church, and that's 121 Ridge Avenue in Darby, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia. And we're going to be having a gathering to try to empower our people politically and economically.
Okay, if you could send me more information about that, and hopefully we can get somebody on tomorrow or Thursday ahead of the event. I certainly would like to help get that information out. Thanks, Brother Ralph.
Thank you.
All right, peace. All right, let me go to 973. Thanks for being patient and hanging on. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Well, good afternoon to you, Mr. Reed, and also to Brother Ralph of Time for Awakening. I do agree with what he was saying. I was definitely at the march.
I know. You told us you were going.
Progress.
Yeah, you told us. Yeah, that y'all were going. So, yeah, go ahead and share whatever it is you like to share, and we will be going more in depth into this as I get more into the speech.
I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know Tando's radio, so give me about maybe a minute and a half.
Go ahead.
Again, it was a great going down there. And one of the things I think what we have to kind of realize, Mr. Reed, is that it's about unity. America needs to know that we are unified. We may not agree with everything Minister Farrakhan, says and things of that nature, but it is always great to see a bunch of African Americans assembled together to listen to words of wisdom. I do agree with Mr. Ralph what he was saying, because I was talking to some people in your organization who were not going down because they felt, you know, the same way about the monetary situation with respect to businesses. There used to be a lot of halal places in the communities, and I don't see them anymore. And I wondered to myself, like, what happened with that? You know, when they had that march back in, I think, 1995, sir, and raised all that money, I would thought that that would probably try to build an economic base in our communities, that we would see more of us. I mean, I'm starting to see more minority-owned, the cleaners are owned by core Koreans. I see laundromats owned by, Hispanics. And I don't see any black-owned businesses in communities, and I'm starting to ask myself why. Now, one of the things I was very happy, being out there, you don't hear everything. It's so funny that when you're out there, you don't really hear. It's like they're all loudspeakers, and the voices are going. It's like mimicking, And I was happy to hear earlier when you played that segment about the B word, and a lot of these reality shows, Mr. Reed, have that B word. It's like a second nature name. So I hope a lot of women out there did hear that message about stop calling women.
Amen.
They use it as a term of endearment, and I don't like that word. I think it's extremely condescending, and for them to use that word, I just think it's just they think it's funny. It's vogue. And I don't think so. So the words I'm saying is that it's great that we can come together and let America know that we still can come together for unity, and we do need justice. And again, as you said, there wasn't a clear-cut direction, Mr. Reed.
Mm-hmm.
What I would want to hear, what does he really want to do? Like going around in circles, and never really, having a means to an end here.
Mm-hmm.
So that I do miss, because we do need clear direction in terms of where we really want to go and what we really want to do. But as far as bringing people together, coming down there and listening to a message and just being unified, I thought that was really good. To see people out there, mingling, shaking hands, the stage changing, business people, I got a lot of magazines I didn't never know of. So it was, in a sense, informational. So that's what I have to say, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. As I have stated in the past, and it's after 6 o'clock. We're still waiting on Brother Dave to give us a call in. Let me go ahead and mute that. I did something wrong here. Hold up.
Q&A queue is cleared.
All right. Once Brother Dave calls in, we will definitely transition to Tando Radio Show right away. Let me see. I don't know what is going on with this thing. But he hasn't called in yet. So these are the notes. And the way that I'm breaking it down is I'm just breaking it down on what I played, what I heard. Again, I was not able to watch the entire 3 hours that he spoke, or 2.5 hours that he spoke in its entirety. And some of the other issues that some of our callers brought up, I will get to those later. I have already, like me and Brother Ralph, already went over my thoughts on Alliance, the struggle with other groups. And, again, there's not going to be any 100% unity in the black community. And I suspect there will never, ever be any kind of 100% unity among non-white people, period. Even though we have a common oppressor, even though if we did, we clearly could end the global system of racism and white supremacy. But that system is so entrenched in this world. It is so diabolical. It has brainwashed or programmed so many people with that white supremacy chip. I just don't think that's possible, because we don't have the access to mass communication to deprogram enough people to combat that racism and white supremacy, which also spreads conflict among. non-white people. So, but I am looking to unify with anybody, like Malcolm X said, if you are sincerely trying to overthrow this system of racism and white supremacy. Again, from military standpoint, I'm looking at spreading the enemy forces thin to exploit his weaknesses by opening up several war fronts. And so that doesn't mean that, you know, we have to be directly working with another group or anything, like, you know, we're all in one group together, this homogenous, you know, entity or whatnot. No, but that does mean that coordinating different activities. Again, you know, I'm looking at it from the perspective of the military, but I have to stress again, only 5% of the people are revolutionaries. Most of the people, man, they are fine with the status quo, or they're cowards and they don't want to challenge the system. They just trying to find a comfortable place in it. So he brought up 12 years of slaves, Solomon Northrop. All right, Solomon Northrop was sitting around doing nothing, didn't give a damn about all the black African people that was enslaved on this continent. He was among those half a million or so, quote-unquote, free black people who were not enslaved. And, you know, he was just trying to make some money and provide for his family. And how he got kidnapped was he trying to do some business with some white supremacists. And them white supremacists set him up for kidnapping. Now, it was only after he obtained his freedom that he became an abolitionist. So my whole point in making a note about that is don't wait till you are enslaved to become an abolitionist. I'm one of the founding members of the New Abolitionist Movement, and we are putting out a call for 10 million new abolitionists to help us end 21st century slavery and human trafficking. And I'm telling you, I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you, don't be a Solomon Northrop sitting around just thinking that, you know, it's all about me and mine. And, you know, I'm free and I'm not going to worry about somebody else's freedom. It's up to them to get their own freedom. No, don't be that guy. Don't be that Solomon Northrop. All right. Become an abolitionist before something happens to you or yours. All right. So that's the only thing I had about Solomon Northrop. He was right about passing the baton and speaking, you know, well, me and Sister Amija on Political Prisoner Radio, and I was in such pain last night. I had some back pain after doing a whole lot of physical activity. I was in tremendous pain. I had took some medication, and I was just out of it, and that's why we did not do Political Prisoner Radio last night. But we have had that conversation, and behind the scenes I have talked to political prisoner activists, former members of the Black Panther Party, former members of the Black Liberation Army, and that is something that has been an issue within that movement, that some of the elders do not want to pass the baton. Some of the elders, you know, not saying that they should sit down and retire, because some of these elders are still out there putting in work. I'm thinking of Sister Jonina and Brother Lorenzo with the Black Autonomy Federation. Those are elders, right? They collecting Social Security, but they ain't sitting on the sidelines. They still engaged in struggle. Both of them former members, or I guess you can never be a former member, but were members of the Black Panther Party that came out of the 60s. And I have heard those conversations about, you know, some of these elders don't want to pass the baton. They don't want to train up a new generation of activists, because they want to stay in, I guess, the limelight or whatever. Or, you know, I don't know. They're just not ready for retirement. But this is a struggle that is centuries old. All right. And perhaps that is one of the disadvantages that we have had, is that we are not passing along all the information, all the knowledge that we should to the next generation. All right. And so I thought that was also important element that he pointed out in that segment of the speech, the importance of passing the baton to the elders. Well, you know, I would say, you know, also, who is he getting ready to pass the baton to? Is he practicing what he preached? Is he preparing, you know, the next generation of quote unquote freedom fighters or something in the NOI? I don't know. But he also spoke about proxy tools of racism. And I know it's hard sometimes for us to change our language, but I have often said, don't call me an African American because I don't want to be associated with Americans. If, you know, you go around the world, Americans are not favorably looked upon considering what this government is doing all across this planet. You know, I'm reminded of the American woman who got stabbed and killed in Yemen. I think it was in Yemen, or the woman who killed her was a Yemeni or something. And certainly Yemen has been on the has been victims of the so-called war on terror, indiscriminately bombing people, killing people with drones and stuff. And I'm talking about entire families, women, children, old people, dogs, cats, you know, just indiscriminate killing. And so I don't want to be associated with that. And then also, you know, I'm just not American. I don't want to be part of this corporation called USA Inc. You know, now I'm forced to pay taxes. I'm forced to adhere to this or that, or else I can go to prison. And I'm just not ready to go to prison for those certain things. You know, not to say that I won't go to prison for things I do, but I just don't want to be associated with Americans. And then also, Columbus, you know, never reached America. I don't know if the minister knows that. He never actually set foot on this continent. The first incursion into this continent by Europeans were the Spanish, who landed on the coast of what is known as North Carolina, the state that I live in, which was the 13th colony of Britain. At the time, one of the 13, and they were the first ones to, the first Europeans to land on these shores, and they made their way inward about 200 or so miles before they got killed by some of my indigenous ancestors, wiped their ass out. And yeah, and then the other colony that got established, the second wave of Europeans came, that was in Jamestown, Virginia, the Pilgrim story. But Columbus never actually set foot on any continental soil here on this continent. But yeah, I don't think we should be calling ourselves American. We are victims of Americans. We're not Americans. We don't have, all the rights and privileges that are afforded to quote unquote citizens of this country. So why do we want to, you know, adopt names like that? You know, say you call yourself an African in America or something like that, or African descendant person in America or something like that. But I reject that term, African American. There's nothing American about me. All right. So, yeah, that's what I think about that. I agree with what the sister brought up about the B word and whatnot. No, we shouldn't be calling each other. Women shouldn't be calling each other bitches and whatnot. But neither should men. Yeah, neither should men. So, yeah, I agree with, I don't have anything to add to that. So, yeah, that's basically everything that I had written down. I had also written down, but this goes to the religious thing. He mentioned Master Fard is still in the world. Master Fard is the man who started the Nation of Islam, who allegedly trained Elijah Muhammad and whatnot. And so he just disappeared from what I've read. Nobody knows what happens to him. And, you know, saying stuff like Master Fard is in the world working for justice and all of that, that's religious mumbo jumbo. Okay, and we can do without the religion and stuff. When we come together as a people or whatnot, and many of us have different faiths, and some of us are atheists, but we down for the struggle. We down for the struggle. And when you bring religion into it, man, you asking for a division. You asking for a division because that's what religion creates. And so again, I think it was very important that Malcolm X you know, when they started the Organization for African, and I'm not going to use that word, but let's just say Africans in America unity, that it was non-religious. It was non-religious, and that's very, we need secular organizations, all right? We need secular organizations that's willing to get their hands dirty. You know, I'm not telling anybody, you know, how to practice their religion, but check your religion at the door, all right? When we come together, just check that at the door. We ain't trying to hear all that. All right, let me see what's going on with Brother Dave. Let me check my email. He usually is always on time, so I get worried. Sometimes when I don't hear from the people I work with. Let me see, Brother Dave. Let me see what is going on with Brother Dave. All right, I don't see anything from Brother Dave. I tell you what I'm going to do is go ahead and play some music while I try to get in touch with Brother Dave, because I don't see Brother Dave called in. I don't see his number whatsoever, and he already sent me the program description. So I'm going to play some music, and we'll transition to Tando Radio Show if he calls in or whatnot. If he doesn't, I will open up the phone lines. We'll stay on air till 6:30 for anybody else that wants to share. If you've already shared, you can share again and whatnot. So you're listening to Black Talk Radio News on Black Talk Radio Network, and we will be back on the other side.
Do you think that the right wing is using the black militants to wage full-scale war against the black people in America?
Well, as I see it, the full-scale war against us has been going on for some 400 years.
I mean, completely, but, wipe us out, the black people out. I mean, that they can open the concentration camps, they can have justification of the backing off the black ghetto, wiring it off, put troops around it. Do you think the right wing agitating the black pantomania or the black militant group in that direction?
I don't really think that whether they're agitating or not, I won't say that they're not, but what they're putting themselves in for is quite a different thing, you see. In other words, as far as black people being slaughtered, we're slaughtered every day, and historically 50 million black people were killed on the Middle Passage alone, according to Melvin J. Herskovich, and this was an act of genocide, which is not talked about, and that the only thing people talk about is the plight of the Jews, where 6 million were killed, and when I state that 50 million black people were killed, just bring them to this country, no one understands this. But what I'm saying is that our real danger is not the Burchites or the Minutemen or some other fanatics. That our danger is really the people who wear the uniform of the establishment, dressed in the clothes of the military or the police department. They're strong enough to wipe us out, they're strong enough to inflict great harm upon the community. And this thing about the fanatics going around agitating, I don't think it will have a great consequence to the black community. The killing of little Bobby Hutton, our treasurer, was a matter of attempting to wipe out the leadership of the Panther, along with getting rid of Eldridge Cleaver, because of his book Soul on Ice, that reveals many things about the corruption of the penal system. Not only the Black Panther Party, black people in general are in danger. As you would note, that in the community where the police ambushed the Panthers, that the police fired upon the community in general. They fired in people's homes where there might have been women and children. Matter of fact, I understand that a child was almost killed, and that it was It was a continuation of the traditional tactic, not only of the Oakland Police Department, but the police throughout the country. And an immediate end will have to be put to this, and I think that what's happening now is that the Black Panther Party is merely speeding up time. As we know that whenever a man becomes frantic and strikes wildly, that he's becoming very weak. He's striking now everyone in the world, and we know that he won't be able to engage the whole colored world into a war, and also fight a civil war here with the revolutionary people of America.
It started in slave ships.
Slave ships. There are more records of slave ships than one would dream. It seems inconceivable. Until you reflect it, for 200 years, ships sailed carrying cargo and slaves.
Non-violent. In the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years, is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. I was not successful in getting in contact with Brother Dave, so I can only assume that his program has been canceled for today, and we just hope that he is all right, because that's very unlike him to schedule a program and not tune in to the program. Call in to conduct his program. So, yeah. We just want to send positive vibes out there and hope that Brother Dave and his family are safe and sound behind these enemy lines. And we can always reschedule this program for a different date. All right. So, I really don't have any other comments on the march. Again, I wasn't able to listen to the entire speech. I shouldn't have said march. The gathering that occurred on the Washington Mall lawn. Again, I will be reviewing the entire speech to see if it's something I missed, to see if there's something that I can glean some useful information from it. Thus far, the first 30 minutes or so, I really didn't hear anything that pertains to any sort of plan of how we gonna get the oppressor's boot off our neck. I do have a suggestion along those lines, though, because they say, if you ain't got a plan, then, don't criticize other people and what they doing. And when I'm talking about criticism, I'm talking about constructive criticism. I wholeheartedly believe, from my studies, from the people that I have talked to, the different movements that I have studied, that if black people or any community wants to be free of police terrorism, they're going to have to follow the motto of the Black Panther Party. I'm talking about not just policing the police and creating armed militias, or you can call them whatever you want to call them, community patrols and stuff like that. And the only people I've seen who have been engaged in that is the Houston branch of the New Black Panther Party. The Huey Newton Gun Club is also, they have that. Those are the only brothers and sisters I've seen who have been engaged in any of the activities in addressing police terrorism that the Black Panther Party started in the 1960s. Of course, starting in 1966, as founded by Huey Newton, And I don't know why I keep forgetting the other brother's name, but yeah, we need to be getting back to those things. We need to be creating community programs, community survival programs, as they call them. You know, we talk a lot about felony disenfranchisement and how, you know, they have snatched the social safety net from under those who have been labeled as felons, and they did that on purpose. You can't get, you know, public housing. You can't go, you know, stay with your grandma or what if she's in public housing while you get on your feet, while you trying to find a job after you've gotten off a prison plantation. No, they bar you from living there. You can't get certain loans and things of that nature. You can't get food assistance from the federal government or the states because you've been labeled a felon. All right. I mean, it even allows for legalized discrimination, because not only will you be barred from any public housing, but it also allows, you know, private property owners to discriminate against you as well. That's totally acceptable, to discriminate against felons, you know, in housing, in employment, in all those things. And so I know oftentimes, you know, a lot of us, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't be addressing the U.S. government through legislative measures. And like, for example, you got what's that brother out of Minnesota, Keith Ellison, and the Senator Rand Paul, when they introduced the REDEEM Act, which would, you know, address many of those problems I just discussed right there. I'm not saying that they shouldn't do that, but we shouldn't wait around on them to do it, because it may never get done. That's just the nature of politics in this country. You can propose this bill, propose that bill, but then you're dependent on a bunch of a majority of white supremacists to co-sign onto that and pass it and implement it. All right, I'm not saying we shouldn't be sitting around waiting on white supremacists to implement justice. What we should be doing is pooling our resources together, just like we have done in the past, to where then, all right, brother, all right, sister, I understand that you in need of some food assistance while you try to get on your feet and while you're trying to find employment, and you've been turned down. They won't allow you to get SNAP, you know, be on the SNAP program and get the little EBT card so that you can, you know, buy some food and whatnot. All right, well, we got this community pantry where you can come, you know, and get some food, you know, to sustain yourself until you are doing better for yourself. You know, we also have this place here where we're serving 3 meals a day to whoever's hungry, whoever wants to come and whatnot. See, we, you know, for the most part, we don't have those things. Yeah, there are some individual churches who operate food pantries. They have clothing drives. I know of a couple of churches in Charlotte that's engaged in that kind of work. But for the most part, they are the exception. They are not the rule. All right. And every church in Charlotte, every mosque in Charlotte, every 501c3, they are not pooling their resources together to meet the needs of the multitude of people who need help. And so those things aren't going on. So, I mean, those are things that we can do without waiting on the government, without getting their permission, without, you know, anyone. That, you know, we can address these issues in our communities ourselves. And we need to be getting back to that, man. We need to be getting back to that. So I think the model that the Black Panther Party laid out for us with their survival programs, with their community patrols of the police, you know, that was a model that worked. And because I feel like if it did not work, the United States government would not have went at such great lengths to destroy them, to frame them up for crimes that they didn't even commit. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover admitted that they felt that the Panthers was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States of America because they were feeding people. He said that. Because, see, when you feed people, you win hearts and minds. When you meet the needs of people, then you win their heart. you then they'll listen to what you have to say, because you're meeting their needs on a physical level. Then you can also address their mental, their spiritual, or whatever it is that they are lacking and that they are in need of. So again, if the what those brothers and sisters did, I mean, they had over 30-something survival programs. The first community clinics, free clinics, were in the black community created by Black Panther Party. The sickle cell testing, which primarily is a disease or blood condition that primarily affects non-white people, especially African-descendant people, the Black Panther Party did that. They did that. And a lot of people, you know, there's a group that I follow on Facebook, this organization that, you know, that's all they work on is sickle cell issues. You know, they don't pay no any kind of homage or give any kind of acknowledgement of whose shoulders they stand on. All right. That was the Black Panther Party that did that. The free breakfast programs, before they was offering free breakfast and lunch in public schools in America, the Black Panther Party was doing that. I already mentioned the food pantry and all of that. And they were also bringing peace in the community as they were getting these drug dealers to stop waging war in the community, creating all of these innocent bystanders and whatnot. They were addressing that. Not from the oppressive, the oppressor's perspective or using their tactics and whatnot. But treating these people like human beings who may not be doing this if they had an alternative to bring in some income. They weren't judging these people. They were trying to help these people. And they were able to convince many of these gangs to become political organizations, registering people to vote, making sure that people in the community were safe, not being a problem in the community. So we already got a blueprint. We already got, you know, a plan. And that's all we need to do is dust those plans off, dust that blueprint off, and implement that blueprint. Because what they were doing was working. Now, we might become political prisoners just like they are political prisoners. Many of them today are political prisoners because of their activity of helping people help themselves. And to empowering people to engage in self-determination and not rely on the government and whatnot. Yeah, they were targeted for those very reasons. So I imagine if we do that again, we can expect the same thing to happen. Just like they're, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, all they're engaged in right now is just raising awareness. They're very young in organizational terms and whatnot. And you know, they have a lot of room to grow, and they're growing, and they're growing. But look at how they're being demonized just for simply organizing protests and demonstrations and calling people out on racism and white supremacy and addressing the issue of police terrorism. Look at how they're being targeted. They ain't feeding nobody. They ain't clothing nobody. They ain't talking about creating no community patrol. All they doing right now, it's just raising awareness and forcing people into uncomfortable conversations about racism and forcing people to come up with a plan to address police terrorism. So, I mean, just those limited things that they're doing, they are being targeted right now by in the same ways that the Black Panther Party was. And they ain't even done one third of what the Black Panther Party was doing. So what I'm saying is, if you do get engaged in anything that's going to lead to true liberation, expect to be targeted. Expect to be targeted. And then you have a choice to make. You know, do you want to take that risk? Are you a courageous person that despite all that could happen to you or that you personally could lose, you know, that, you know, well, I'm not in this for self. I'm not in this for my personal gratification or my personal safety or being comfortable. No, I have a greater purpose than that. And that purpose is to help my people obtain that liberation and help them do better and get to a better place. So, again, I don't think that we need to be looking to any new leaders or any old leaders or anything like that to come up with a plan when we already got a blueprint that has already shown that it can work. Because if not, it would have been destroyed. Let me go to this call. Area code 480, thanks for chiming in. I don't know how long you was hanging on through my diatribe there, but... thanks for being patient. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Absolutely. This is Sister Isatu out in Tempe, Arizona, Brother Scotty.
Hey, greetings to you, sis. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. I was just had a comment about the economic part of what you were saying with when it comes to the new abolitionist.
New abolitionist movement?
Yes, thank you. I can't pronounce that. But I've brought this forward to a couple of people when I attended the Million Man March event at ASU when I was bringing up this subject. And I was asking, you know, if people had property or anything like that, because a lot of the problems that I've noticed with people coming out of jail is that they are waiting for halfway houses, they're waiting for homes, they're waiting for somewhere to go. Mm-hmm. So if our people that do own property or have access to buy property can start purchasing apartment buildings and places so that we can make these halfway houses so that we can get our people, have a place for our people to go. So that's one of the reasons why some people that are eligible to get out cannot get out, because they just don't have anywhere to go.
I am so glad you brought that up. I'm so glad. If I could just interrupt you for a second, what you just said is very important, and I never even considered that. But that I would put under a survival program, because, you know, from our studies of modern slavery, 21st century slavery and human trafficking, you know, here recently we've been seeing a lot of movement in abolishing private prisons. And when I say movement, in terms of legislation being introduced, in terms of that being part of a national discussion. But one of the ways that they profit, the corporations profit off of 21st century slavery and human trafficking, is these so-called halfway houses and whatnot. And so why you raise an interesting point. Why aren't we operating our own halfway houses so that our brothers and sisters have somewhere to go that don't have nowhere to go? And that's a condition of their release. They have to have, you know, a support system when they get out. That's a very excellent point you bring up, one I had not even considered.
That's right. And, you know, the funds are out there because I'm just going to bring it back to the Million Man March. When they asked for donations the first time, I donated. I'm 39 years old right now, and I was old enough to participate in the last march, and I participated in this one financially and with my energy. And one of the things that I brought up this time when I at the event was I was really pushing this new modern-day slavery. And I'm just like, hey, with this money, how come does the nation own a Chicago apartment complex in Chicago? No. Do they own an apartment complex anywhere, USA? No. You know, I'm just, you know, we need to be putting people, holding people accountable. All these mega churches, do they own any property that they can bring people into that are coming out of jail, that their members are, have household members that are coming out of jail? No. There's not one. I was just trying to do the research, and the ones that there are, they're very, very, very tiny, that they're barely a blip on the map. As in, they only can house two or three people at a time because they're using their own private home. But, I mean, come on, a four- or five-bedroom house in the Midwest somewhere, $100,000, done, paid for. We got a halfway house, you know, for women. And, you know, we can make one so their children can be there. You know, so there's all kinds of ideas that we can come together with to get this done. I brought the women up because there's a very high shortage of halfway houses available for women. They cater more to the male population, but there is very, very high demand for women. So there's a lot of women sitting in jail longer than they need to be there, just simply because there is not an availability for them. But, you know, the both sexes are in need. But I just brought women up because I was very affected by the sister at the march when she was bringing the plea of the women and the children, how they are separated. And being a mother of five, that just touched my heart to be like, okay, how can we get these families back together, you know?
You know, and, on the issue,
that's pretty much all I have to say.
On the issue of, like you was asking, do they own this apartment complex or that apartment complex? And I was having a conversation with my mother. Somehow we got on the subject of, yeah, I know how we got on the subject of Beyonce and booty pics and stuff like that, because I got a cousin who's on Facebook who happens to be a member of the Nation of Islam, and he always sharing booty pics on Facebook, right? And so my mom joined Facebook about a month ago or something, and I was like, uh-oh, when she starts seeing what he posting, I know she gonna call him out. And so that's how she called him out. And then she told me about it, and that's how we got on the conversation of Beyonce, because I had relayed to her what the minister had said to Jay-Z about covering up, telling Beyonce to cover up and whatnot. And, you know, whether or not, you know, he can be telling another man, you know, how to communicate and what to communicate to his wife. With all of that aside, that's how we got on that conversation. And then so she was talking about, you know, how Beyonce and other women, they take off their clothes, you know, and show all their skin because they trying to make money in this capitalistic system. And I was like, that's true. But I said, did you know I had read that Beyonce had actually built an apartment building? From what I read, it was huge. Had built an apartment building through the church that she, I think this church is in Texas. I could be wrong about that. But that, you know, through that church that she had grew up in, that she had sung in, that through them, they were operating an apartment building for, you know, to provide low income housing. And I was like, that's wonderful. That's great. You know, a lot of times, you know, some of these people, they get a lot of publicity for the bad things that they do. But then when they do something good, you know, like that, and they're giving back to the community, well, they don't get a whole lot of attention for that. And I think the reason is because they don't want others to be inspired, other celebrities, other multimillionaires to do the same. And so, you know, that kind of ties into what you're saying. You know, we are, not only are we in need of more housing for people, you know, who low income housing, as they call it. But that element in terms of abolitionism and the new abolitionist movement that you bring up about, we need housing so some of these people can get off the prison plantation. I had never thought about that. And I want to thank you again, Sister Isatu, for bringing that up. And that's something that we're going to have to look into.
You inspired me, Brother Scotty. Thank you. I wouldn't even thought about any of this unless I had started listening to your program with you and the other two brothers back during the whole Michael Brown situation is what brought me to this situation, so this present moment. So honestly, all of that goes right back to you. You know, you're the one that got this brain turning on a new idea.
Well, let's say we inspire each other, and that's how it should be, right?
There you go. That's right.
All right, Sister Isatu.
Right,
let me ask you this, though, because you had called in and said that, you know, you weren't able to travel to Washington, D.C. this time, but you were going to watch it streamed at Arizona State University, I think you said. And so were you able to network with anyone there? Did you have any positive interactions to report?
Yes, I do have some positive interactions. I met some members from, a self-defense coalition that's locally here in in Arizona, and I was very happy to see that. And I look forward to helping my children start training with them and their children and things. And that was my biggest moment, because I'm more into the LRLs part more than the justice part.
Mm-hmm.
But, and, you know, with that, I was still left a little confused, and I just kept hearing Nellie Filler in my head saying, if you don't understand white supremacy, you just, everything else will confuse you. And the speech sort of left me confused, because it didn't seem like it addressed, you know, a clear plan of what we should be doing next. But all I did see about that was a great opportunity to network. Most of the people there were NOI members.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very set in their ways, I'm just going to say.
Mm-hmm.
They have a doctrine that they believe and they're following, and I respect that. And I just, you know, I just was really talking about the halfway houses. I really pressed that and asked about if they had any in Chicago, and do they own any apartment complex in Chicago or Detroit, because that was another one of their strongholds. And Detroit has the value of property has gone down so low in Detroit. I was just really pressing that they get out there and start buying up property in Detroit.
Yeah.
And why aren't they? And, you know, that was my whole thing. I was sort of holding them accountable. I was not trying to be confrontational. I might have came off a little confrontational, but I'm very serious about the liberation of our people.
Mm-hmm.
And the or else part, because we do, when I tell my children or else, they know mama means business. I'm serious.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm like, hey, you either clean this kitchen or else there's going to be some consequences.
You also mentioned earlier in your call that you were spreading the new abolitionist message to these brothers and sisters and letting them know that slavery was never abolished. It was only amended. And were they receptive to the new abolitionist message?
Yes, the men that I spoke with, they converted into Islam out of the penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew about that. Mm-hmm. That movement, not the movement as in there's actually people trying to work on that, but they knew about something about that. You know, I don't want to say they knew as much as you and the two brothers know about it, especially breaking down the states and, you know, all the rules and the constitutions and stuff. But they were aware, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Nation of Islam, a lot of their members that were there were aware, because they're the ones that were reaching out to these, you know, the coalition that was there.
Mm-hmm.
For the Alliance for People Incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was Nation of Islam members that reached out to those people and brought them to the forum. So, yeah, they're slightly aware, but they weren't really talking about that. That's why I was trying to fill them out to be like, okay, well, what's the plan then? You know what? I mean, what are we going to do? You know, because you got one farm, but if we're, you know, in order to lead a nation, we need an infrastructure and we need all kinds of stuff. So, you know, I'm down to do something. You know, I don't care if I have to lose weight or get hungry and, you know, tighten my belt buckle. Whatever I need to do, I'm willing to do it. But I just really couldn't get any clear answers from anybody except for, you know, come to the mosque. I got a lot of that. Come to the mosque. But I was raised in the Nation of Islam, and I don't need to go to the mosque anymore. I'm ready for some action. I don't need to be, I don't need to Sunday school. I would just like to get a plan and act it out. Time is short. My children are getting to the age where they can be incarcerated, and actually they're already at the age of incarceration.
Right.
The way this nation moves and puts children, locks them up, you know. So I'm just like, you know, we need to do something. And I'm talking about tomorrow as in Monday morning. What y'all doing on Monday? You know, I was really asking people what they doing on Monday. What are you doing on Monday? Oh, you know, we're going back to work. But if you come in on Saturday and Sunday, you know, to the mosque, you know, then I guess I need to go there, and then we can network from that point on and build from there. That's what I got. I didn't get too much. That's why I'm very vague about answering you, because they're very vague about answering me, so I really can't tell you.
Right, right.
Tell you anything, Brother Scotty.
Well, at least you met some people, like you mentioned, they're working on self-defense.
It was beautiful.
Yeah, they're working on self-defense.
It was beautiful. And people were, you know, the energy was high. People were happy. You know, and I do think that people were eager to do something. It's just, where was the direction at?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where was, I just didn't, I think I wasn't the only one that was feeling sort of directionless. It's just that nobody was speaking it.
Okay.
Nobody was saying it. You know, like, okay, now what?
Right.
You know, I wish somebody would have said, now what, Nobby? Because I would have laughed and participated. I'm, you know, I was like, yeah, I agree. Now what? You know?
And,
I guess I go home now
and
call Brother Scotty.
And I'll say this, you know, not only to you, but to everybody that's listening right now or will listen later. A lot of the or else we can't talk about publicly. All right. We got to talk about that among ourselves behind closed doors, not over the telephone, not over a conference line or anything like that. You know, as our first guest was talking about the extent of the spying that the different alphabet agencies do. But a lot of the things that pertains to or that you would think pertains to or else. Those conversations need to be had confidentially because, you know, they're always looking to set us up. They're always looking to get new slaves for the plantation. So, you know, we just also need to be intelligent about what we talk about and who we talk about it with and the platform or the forum where we discuss those things. A lot of things ain't for the public to know. And that's all I got on that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was a very intelligent response, and I'll take heed. And that's you're right on that 100%. Is Brother Thandel not going to have his radio show this evening?
No, I'm kind of worried about
like
him.
He would say.
Yeah, I'm worried about him because, you know, he's usually always, well, I ain't going to say usually, he's always, whenever he schedules a show, he's right there, you know, on time and ready to do his show. So it's very uncharacteristic for him not to have shown up. I haven't even gotten an email from him canceling. So I just hope that whatever has prevented him from doing this program isn't something so serious that, you know, either he got hurt or a family member got hurt or whatnot. So I really don't have any information to report, but just keep him in your prayers.
Did you hear about the reparations? Did you cover that topic? How the Israelis got reparations and the Native Americans just recently, Obama signed a new reparations.
Yes, I've heard about that. I haven't actually done a program discussing it, but I have heard others discussing it. And, you know, this is my thing with reparations, is that, you know, first of all, the people that's involved in the reparations movement need to become part of the new abolitionist movement, because you're asking for reparations in a sense that you want compensation for something that occurred in the past to your ancestors, when the reality and the facts on the ground say it's happening to you right now. So that's kind of premature to ask for compensation for a crime that's ongoing. All right. And so, you know, I don't ever foresee the USA Inc. coming up off of any kind of currency or compensation. Not to say that people shouldn't be working towards that, but at the same time, again, any reparations movement also needs to consider the fact that the crime of slavery has not ended and is still ongoing, and we need to be focused primarily on getting our people out of slavery. Those are my thoughts, sis.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right. We're going to go ahead and wrap up the program. Again, keep Brother Dave in your prayers. Send positive vibes out. Make sure that, you know, nothing has happened to him. I'm sure I'll hear something later. And I just don't want to think the worst. But it's very unlike him not to show up for his program. All right. So check this out. Recognize the fact that you live behind the enemy lines of USA Inc., that this place they called America is a battlefield out there, and there are casualties being created every day. Don't believe me. Don't take my word for it. Look at the database, killedbypolice.net. I have been in a war zone. For those that don't know, I'm a former U.S. Army I worked in communications, and I had a top secret security clearance, and I got to look at top secret data concerning casualties on that battlefield out there in Iraq. And let me tell you, in terms of U.S. military soldiers, whether we're talking about the Gulf War, whether we're talking about their actions in Iraq today or in Afghanistan or anywhere on this planet, there are not a huge amount of American, quote unquote, casualties being created. There are more, quote unquote, American citizens, or let's call them residents, who are being killed by police than enemy soldiers are killing U.S. soldiers. I don't care where you at on the planet. That should be very troubling to you. All right. That should be very troubling. That should be a concern of yours. And we know most of the people that listen to this program, that we, or this network, we know it's a concern of yours as well. All right. So once you come to the realization of all these facts that, you know, we live in an active war zone, then hopefully you will develop codification, you will develop battlefield awareness, you will develop skills that can decrease the likelihood that you will become a casualty. Again, there is no foolproof method. There are no suggestions that I can make to you that I could say if you follow these steps right here, I can guarantee you will never be enslaved or you'll never get killed by one of these killer cops. No, you know. But what I can say is there are certain things that you can do to decrease the likelihood that those things will happen to you or to your family. All right. And so we need to be at all times working to end this system of racism and white supremacy. And it's a global system. So till tomorrow, peace and blessings to all. This is Scotty Reed, and I'm signing off.